And then he says, after heading up the academy for a few years, Watts left the faculty for a freelance career in the mid-50s. He began what became a long-running weekly radio program at Pacifica radio station, KPFA, in Berkeley. So that's when, I guess, Gerd was there, though Gerd, I think, thinks of it as earlier. Then he published in 1957, I think this is the book you were thinking of, he published one of his best-known books, The Way of Zen, which focused on philosophical explication and history. Besides drawing on the lifestyle and philosophical background of Zen in India and China, Watts introduced ideas from general semantics, directly from the writings of Korzybski.
Yes.
And also from Norbert Wiener's early work on cybernetics, which had recently been published. Watts offered analogies from cybernetic principles possibly applicable to the Zen life. The book sold well, eventually becoming a modern classic, and helped widen his lecture circuit. Around this time, Watts toured parts of Europe with his father, meeting the renowned psychiatrist Carl Jung. In relation to modern psychology, Watts' instincts were closer to Jung's or Abraham Maslow's than to those of Freud.
Yes.
Okay, now listen to this. When he returned to the United States, he began to dabble in psychedelic drug experiences, initially with mescaline given to him by Dr. Oscar Janiger. You ever heard of him?
Yep.
He tried LSD several times with various research teams led by Drs. Keith Dittman, Sterling Bunnell, and Michael Agron. He also tried DMT, later stating that it was like, quote, loading the universe into a gun and firing it into your brain.
That's immediately.
DMT. Yeah, that's DMT. Watts' books of the 60s revealed the influence of these chemical adventures on his outlook. He would later comment about psychedelic drug use, quote, when you get the message, hang up the phone.
Et cetera. Yes.
And then it says, for a time, Watts came to prefer writing in the language of modern science and psychology. His book, Psychotherapy East and West, is a good example. Finding a parallel between mystical experiences and the theories of the material universe proposed by 20th century physicists. He later equated mystical experience with ecological awareness, and typically emphasized whichever approach seemed best suited to the audience he was addressing. So they imply, you know, that LSD happened, you know.
Yeah, I know.
Around that time.
Well, I think after having that first session, then all that other happened.
Right.
They don't have that in Wikipedia, but that's all right. But the big blip that I have has to do with the ex-wife or the wife, the divorce. Now, the annulment and the timing and all that, I knew through others that whoever she was, that she was a thorn in his side and required lots of money. And I think I even heard him say that's why he had to write.
Okay, that's interesting.
But that's neither here nor there. It doesn't, the only thing is, if his wife had been with him longer and divorced him, then my retelling of it would be accurate. But if he had his marriage annulled, which seems strange, after they'd been together so long, I didn't know you could annul it that easy, unless it was a Catholic marriage type of thing that required...
I don't think so. He becomes an Anglican minister.
Later, though, but... Yeah. So, anyway, that's very interesting and elucidating for me. But there definitely was some kind of a trip there. They don't say that he married again and divorced, but...
No, they may. There may be more later years. It goes into his later years, but it doesn't seem...
Well, it would have been... The divorce would have been before... well before 1960, as I gather. If it had any holds any water. But let's not spend any more time on that.
Right. I want to just go back up and find the part about her and click on it to see if they show... the Catholic thing. Where was her early years? Where did he mention this? I was reading. It only goes into her mother. So let's see what she.
And her mother was involved with the
Buddhism
already.
Yeah.
From that side. That's interesting.
Yeah, and she's an American. Ruth Fuller was born and grew up in Chicago. That's the mother. She took piano lessons in Switzerland, studied French and German. She married...
I think I had heard of her, but not... I didn't know it was from this. Go ahead.
Okay, so it doesn't indicate she was a Catholic. So, if the marriage is annulled, do you have to pay alimony?
That's the point that I wouldn't think so,
yeah.
But maybe they had an agreement that that he kept, you know?
Yeah. Okay, so November 16th, 1973, Alan Watts died. 1973.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's move on here. Bob says, Grace and I became friends and spent many an evening together. Do you remember being part of those evenings?
Not necessarily. I think there was lots of stuff that went on over there, and I was very busy over in San Francisco. And I would see her at Subud Latihan, you know, because the women went to their room and the men. And then I would see her at this woman's house that Watts had been in, but then at some point Watts moved to the ferry, but I still went to that house, and I think Mildred did too, but...
Right, now, is this around the time you and Mildred decide not to be married?
No, that occurred at a later point, after Chris and I had a crisis, and actually... he had practically a nervous breakdown, and I remember that they came and got me out of the apartment we shared and moved me in with them out in West San Francisco.
Who, Bob and Connie?
Yeah, and I think Mildred might have been involved, and I think there were some Subud people involved, too.
Right. He says he stayed in Bob's house for about, you know, only 4 months. So they did move. He says he found a job in San Francisco working for an insurance company that wanted to have its own in-house printing facility. Do you remember that?
Oh, Bob and Connie. Yeah, something like that. He set up a thing that was called Contact Printing.
Right, that's after, I think that's after, he talks about working there for a few years, then he sets up his own printing business.
Well, it wasn't very long. It was right away. Not very long after he left Philman's house and was in San Francisco, and he had this whole complex. Now, maybe he was, I mean, I saw it, it was called Contact Printing. Now, what he did for who and what, I don't know.
Right.
Except that his assistant was a guy, And Bob was asked to do a poster for a concert.
Yeah, this is the Wes Wilson connection.
Yeah, but Wes Wilson hadn't done anything yet. He was Contact Printing was printed up these posters, and so they became known for that, and. Then, at a later point, when all these concerts started happening and Wes Wilson started doing, I don't know whether Bob and Connie set him up on that or whether they were kind of behind as he did it, but there was a strong relationship with him. I had a fairly incredible encounter with him myself. Oh, but that's a whole story that you may or may not want to go into.
Well, we may go into that after I give a bit of the history of that period, which involves Wes. He says, Grace and I became friends and spent many an evening together. Once we went to Disneyland, she just couldn't believe our enjoying ourselves. It was making fun of us until the little blue pill took its effect.
Ah, little blue pill. That's when they had the little Sandoz pills.
They're, oh, okay, that's what it was.
They were 25 micrograms each.
Okay. She said, so, you know, they're already stoned, and she's couldn't believe how they were enjoying themselves, and then she started to get affected. Bob writes, then it was impossible to get her to leave the park until it closed. After we returned to our hotel, she admitted she had no idea how much fun Disneyland could be.
Yes.
We stayed in Bob's house for about 4 months. Our money was running out. We saw that it was time to go back to work. Connie found a job in his old trade, the supermarket. As for myself, believe it or not, I found a job in San Francisco working for an insurance company that wanted to have its own in-house printing facility. I had learned the ins and outs of printing when we had the center, as we had printed all our graphics, books, and so on. So now I was working at it, making money for the first time in 8 years. We needed to decide what to do with Biff, as there was no time to take care of him properly. A zoo in Tacoma, Washington wanted him. So we drove up one weekend and said goodbye to our little friend. We were both attached to him, but he was getting older and more difficult to handle.
And bigger. Yeah.
Do you remember that, him going
up? Oh, yeah.
We knew that it was just a matter of time when we would have to find a permanent home for him to live out his years. When we returned to Oakland, we told Bob that we were going to move to San Francisco as soon as we could find a place to live. We found a small house and moved in and began to settle in the San Francisco scene, making new friends and living just an ordinary kind of life. No one knew of our life in Seattle. It was interesting to be just an ordinary person with no special image or knowledge. Being at the center had been a game of maintaining the reputation of being a guru, the one who knew and therefore the one who would help others to get what they imagined they wanted to achieve in life. Now, this is what you go through later yourself, right?
Well, I think I went through it pretty early.
At the center as trip master?
At the center, yeah. In other words, I consider that Krishnamurti gave me the clues, Korzybski gave me the clues, Isis Unveiled gave me the clues, and all of a sudden I was on acid. and being advised by Hollywood Hospital to set up this research, which I wouldn't do myself. I was glad to make the connection, but I said, you have to. So that, in other words, even though I was the initial interview, I immediately turned it over to Bob and Connie. However, during the therapy, I was the key therapist, whether anybody wants to acknowledge it or not. I know that Hollywood Hospital acknowledged it. But at a certain point, there were enough of us doing enough things that I'm sure nobody's name could be put on anything after a while, you know. But as far as the catalyst, the trigger, the connection, etc., that's all I'm talking about.
Right. Yeah, you said after a while, there no particular name was the leader. Is that what you're saying?
In fact, in other words, amongst the multiple therapists, we were all, I think, equal, and mutual discoverers.
Right.
But there's a factor that I didn't include at that time. It was years before Elliot Craig told me that I traveled while on acid.
Yeah.
I mean, I always felt that everybody traveled, you know, that whatever I was doing, everybody was doing. And then he says, no, you do this thing of traveling, and he says, you travel all over the world and sometimes into other people's acid sessions and out. And he said, I couldn't do it, but if you did it, I could follow.
Right.
And so he had been arranging to drop in and travel every once in a while over those years, and I didn't know it. So it's curious as to how much, if he was a CIA agent, how much information he got that way by just traveling with me. Because I know I had a lot of information that didn't mean much to me, but I did have it, you know.
So you're saying, though, that you had a bit of authority in the early paid part as a catalyst, and that was your being a little guru.
Of course, Well, no, I wasn't. The little guru bit didn't happen to me for years when they tried to make me one, and I refused to be one.
When you became a channel for cosmic awareness.
Yeah, when I would go various places and people tried to treat me as a guru, I'd put a stop to it right away because I knew the mischief of that from way back. And so I never did become a guru. But I remember at one time at Clearview when somebody was trying to pull that on me, and I said, no. And that's when Vern, Chris, called me Baba Rum Dum. That was after Baba Rum Das.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, Clearview is the early 70s, or 73, 74.
Yeah.
Okay, so the point is you're laughing at where Bob's saying, being at the center had been the game of maintaining the reputation of being a guru, the one who knew, and therefore the one who would help others to get what they imagined they wanted to achieve in life.
And that, he was free of that.
Yes, and you tasted a bit of that position at this as a catalyst at the LSD thing.
Not focused as a guru, though.
Yes.
But I know what was happening to him. I knew that was happening to him.
Okay. He says, here I was in San Francisco, just another human being, nobody special. I kept a watchful eye on my urge to talk, to be someone special. I was... He says, I was well aware that if I let it get started, it would be so very easy to use it to help me get what I wanted from others. I could so easily exploit people to fulfill my own needs. I would often spend my time off just walking about the city, sometimes meeting others. Often,
yeah.
People...
He was out cruising.
Yeah. He loved to cruise in peace. Often people would begin to unload their thoughts and problems. Of course, I listened and understood. Everyone is full of problems. We want this or that. Our life is a constant search for pleasure without pain, but the two go hand in hand. The urge to help others was there in me, but what could I do? But what could I do? I could only listen and try to approach the problem without recourse to religious answers, to see if it was possible simply to point out what there was. I was still a guru at heart, if it was there in me, as part of me. No, say it again. I was still a guru at heart. It was there in me, as part of me, but not needing to be acted out. Now, he talked
about... Yeah, not as a need.
No.
In other words, as like the difference between channeling for money for... with entities to do that, or being able to move into those levels to discover. It's like that's the difference. Essentially he was had all the qualities of a real guru of India, which has nothing to do with manipulation, which he had assumed as a guru with manipulation, and now he was free of it.
Right. Now, when did you become aware of this manipulation game?
Right from the beginning, because the first time I saw him, I didn't want anything to do with him because I thought that's what was there, and I was right.
Right. That
I was not informed much about spiritism or things like that. So I just felt always another one of those screwballs who read Zoras, which is what he did at Keith Reinhardt's.
Yes.
And curiously, that was the day Conrad was there in the crowd, and when he saw him, he said, "This I want." So here we had two people on opposite sides of the room who didn't know each other. One was saying, "This I want," and another one, like me, saying, "This I don't want." And it took months before I was invited to a dinner at the center through Claire Olson.
Olson, yeah.
Now, she had been in the OSS, and the woman who had set up his first house in Seattle, Grace Chapman, was in the OSS.
Yeah.
And, of course, the OSS became the CIA, and therefore they were thick with Collins and...
Craig.
Even there were events I heard about that happened amongst them that were related years later of some of the therapy they were doing with Carbogen, which I didn't know it had been used that early. It was years later before I knew about its use.
Betcher, we're talking about... I talked to Bob Carr both that first night where Connie sees him. He says that they didn't go home together that night. They went up for coffee. He said that Connie came over to the center shortly after. Then he noticed Connie more, and then they went up for coffee, and then they got together. But your memory is that you think...
I don't know.
Right.
All I know is that Connie told the story about it. That's how I knew that that it was the same night, that we were both there, and we had laughs about it, because he went for him, and I didn't. And anyway, Connie said, yeah, I thought he said they went
that
right
night.
To it. Well, of course, people have ways of jumping time or not.
Right.
So I'm not, I can't say, because I wasn't there. And I don't think I assumed it.
Right. You were told.
I think I'm relating it to some kind of factual information at the time.
Yeah, Connie collapsed the events into, you know, generally around the same time, made it one night. He may have done that.
Well,
a series of events that went over a week, he made it.
See, the thing is, when people make discoveries, they're out of time anyway.
Right, right.
Often.
They're out of time. No more time.
Well, the attention is shared, and it isn't by the clock.
Right. Okay, he says he ran into his old friend Kent Chapman. Did you meet him? You remember that name, Kent Chapman?
You mentioned it before, I think.
Oh, okay. So
now, let's see. What does he say about Kent Chapman?
He had been living in Venice near Los Angeles, writing poetry and living off the kindness of strangers, so to speak. Kent was now living in North Beach in San Francisco, and he was glad to see me after some...
Oh, this is down there. Okay, all right.
No, then he's in North Beach. When Kent Chapman was in Venice, but he comes up to San Francisco, and Bob Carr sees him in San Francisco. He said he was glad to see me after so many years. Christopher Isherwood, the writer, was encouraging Kent to write, but Kent was so scattered and unfocused, he could barely get enough money together to pay his rent. And
he was a beat.
Yeah. He now spent some of his time at our house. We let him sleep on the sofa at night. In spite of his problems beneath the surface, Kent was an artist in search of a canvas to paint upon. He fell in love with every pretty face he met, staying up late in the night, smoking and drinking coffee at Foster's on Polk Street. Do you know Foster's on Polk Street?
Yeah, you see, Polk Street was the gay bar street.
Ah.
There were several gay bars up and down Polk Street, and there was a Foster's there.
Okay, so this...
Foster's, you know, is like a chain of coffee restaurants.
Okay, so here's the relevant connection. He says, methadone was his drug of choice. He'd become addicted to it when in the army in Korea. Well, at least that's what he said. Under Kent's persona was a sweet, helpless guy looking for the next fix. Meth or sex or some pleasure to dull his pain. One evening, Kent introduced me to another artist friend, Wes Wilson, who was living in the Wentley Arms rooming house on Polk Street. Was Wes Wilson gay? He was living on Polk Street?
I am not positive.
Okay.
I sort of thought he was by the interchange. See, he worked for Contact. Does he say that he went to work for him?
Okay, well, we'll see. This is a good couple paragraphs here because it kind of leads into the 60s. And Bob had done the 60s in the 50s, you know what I mean, in a way. So he says, the place, Wentley Arms, the place was full of retired beatniks, starving artists, and other misfits. Wes began to come over to the house to hang out with a newly forming group of young musicians and artists.
All right. Now we come. Okay, let's hear what he has to say about that. I'll interject with my little Wes Wilson story in a bit.
Okay, so Connie bought a piano and some tape recording equipment. So we had jazz sessions on Sunday afternoons with a room full of listeners. I started painting again, and we made the front room into a Japanese setting with a water pond and fountain.
It was and next to it was a room they turned into a recording studio.
Right, okay. He says it was a...
With a window and everything.
Okay, it says it was a perfect setting for a party or anything else one wanted to do. Alan Watts brought some friends who became part of the new happenings that were going on in San Francisco. As the early years of the early 60s unfolded, the birth of the hippies was happening in small groups here and there, springing up all over the city. There was something new in the air. You could feel it. Something new was emerging. Now, this is 61, you know, 61, 62.
Yeah, it's on Geary Street.
Okay.
They were surrounded. There was about a half a square block that was a terrazzo factory, and right in the middle of it was an apartment, which originally had been offices, but then they moved their offices out of that and then rented out the apartment. It was like a seven-room apartment that was completely surrounded so they could make all the noise they wanted and it wouldn't disturb anybody, and they were right in the top of the hill next to Sears, and lots of happenings happened there. Now, let's see what else they have to say about that.
So he's talking about the hippies beginning, the early hippies.
Then he's jumping through onto the early
hippies. Yeah, he's going to lead to a general statement here.
He's not going to tell any more about the Geary place.
He is going to, but here's this generalization. He's saying something new is emerging. This new generation was not going to buy all that crap the politicians and religious leaders were dishing out. And then Bob says, or he thought, oh, my God, is there really a change coming, or is it just a reaction to the old system? Then he says, only a few friends knew of my background, and for me it was like a test. I had not been talking about what I knew about understanding oneself or about all my interest in what Krishnamurti had to say about life. Alan Watts and Grace were both the only people that knew about Connie's and my interest, and Dave, of course, you. Kent had finished school in Ohio.
But see, I wasn't living in San Francisco at that time, but I visited.
Oh, well, but you were. You were working at the Emporium.
No, I left the Emporium in about September of 62, maybe August of 62, and shifted down to Palo Alto until November when I was shifted to Seattle suddenly.
Right, and that's when you met Doobie again. But here's the thing.
Well, I took Doobie to the airport. See, while they were at that place.
We got that on tape, Dave. Let's just stay on this. We already did all that. But unless there may be a new angle we bring in later. But just, he's talking about 61, 62, 63, because on the next page he goes, it was now about 1964, and I had been doing print work for the past 4 years for the insurance company. And they were moving their head office to Pasadena, blah, blah, blah. But anyways, so you were there in 60. Do you remember seeing these parties at the place with the jazz sessions?
Well, I knew all about them. I wasn't there for very much of them because I was just on vacation in, I think, 1963. But it could have been 64. I can't remember.
Right.
It was a vacation, and that's where... the Wes Wilson
story happens.
All right.
Okay, because the interesting thing, so you were around Bob and Connie in 61, 62 when you were working at the Emporium, but this scene hadn't really started as far as you know.
No, because they hadn't moved to that until after I left. Wait a minute. No, they had moved there because that's when Doobie and they were working on this concept of taking over the Winter Garden and setting up banquet rooms to have sessions in.
What was the Winter Garden? Just a big hotel or what?
No, it was a big, like a concert hall.
Okay.
It became fairly known as a concert hall during the hippie days.
I remember that later, and that's the place you're talking about. But there were lots of rooms in it?
I don't think there were, but they were going to create them.
Okay. All right. And they were. This is where, like, Ken Kesey and Leary act out later what your group, Ralph and you guys, were thinking of. You know, this is the psychodrama, the xenocrity, where it goes out from you people.
All right, anyway, back to the Wes Wilson event.
Okay, let's just finish this. So he goes, Alan Watts and Grace were both the only people who knew about Connie's and my interests. Kent had finished school in Ojai at the Happy Valley. Are you there? Okay, sorry about that. We got disconnected, a little blipper here. So we left off with Dave laughing at this sentence. Kent Chapman had finished school in Ojai at the Happy Valley School. The school was run somewhat along Krishnamurti's lines, and it had messed Kent up. He was fed up with Ojai. Of course, Kent was overly sensitive and self-absorbed with his problems, but he was talented and very intelligent. One night, Kent and Wes dropped by to listen to some music. After a little while, Wes asked if I knew anything about LSD. Quote, Bob Carr responds, "Why? What do you want to know, Wes?" I asked. Wes says that Kent had told him that Bob had taken it quite often and knew how to guide a newcomer through his first trip. So Bob says to Wes, "Yes, I could help, but really I don't think you'll have any trouble. But if you want to do it for sure, when would you like to?" "Hmm," said Wes, "well, what about next Saturday?" "Okay, just come on over. What about your girlfriend, Eva? You remember Eva, Dave?" Not really, okay? So
not really.
"Okay, what about your girlfriend, Eva?" I asked. "Oh," said Wes, "she doesn't want to take it, but she can come. But can she come too?" "Sure, just skip breakfast that morning. It's better on an empty stomach," I advised. So Wes and Eva arrived Saturday about noon, and Wes told me he was ready. Now, Wes goes on to become the king of making psychedelic posters. You can look him up in Wikipedia, you know, for the Bill Graham and everybody.
Yeah, I knew that.
Right. So, so Bob tells them, or tells Wes, Eva's not going to take it. She's just going to watch. "Just relax. I'll fix your orange juice." Wes said, "Can you play some Spanish guitar records that I brought?" "Of course," I said, walking back into the front room, giving Wes his special orange juice. Wes said, "Well, okay, here goes," and drank his juice. "No taste," he said. I replied, "Yes, Wes, just make yourself comfortable and I'll play some music." The drapes were drawn, so the room was darkened and the outside noise was muffled. Eva looked at Wes and asked, "Do you feel anything?" "No," he replied, "not yet." And then Wes looked around the room and at the Japanese screens. I turned on the water fountain in the corner. I said to Eva, Bob said, "It's best just to relax and let Wes go on his own. He's okay." Eva said, "I'm just a bit nervous," and half smiled at both of us. The music began to carry Wes away into that world that cannot be described or communicated very well. Wes began to laugh, closed his eyes, and lay back on the floor. He was gone. I said to Eva, quote, "He's fine, just let him enjoy," unquote. Hours later, Wes was looking at the kitchen tile floor and said he could see all the human archetypes superimposed on the floor, changing shapes. He was fascinated and wanted to stay there looking at all those shapes. So this is what's going to get him into the psychedelic poster, this trip here.
His capacity, yes.
Yeah, this is the beginning of the psychedelic poster art in the large level, I guess. You know, this trip is the beginning. Several hours later, I sent both of them home to further enjoy his experience. Later, Wes told me that it was the most fantastic experience he had ever had, and that it changed his way of looking at things. He said that he and Eva both went for a walk that night along the streets, and that the city was fantastic. Quote, Wes says, "It was as if I were seeing my neighborhood for the first time," he reported. Bob says, "It was now about 1964, and I had been doing print work for the past 4 years for the insurance company. They were moving." Now, at this point, Leary is talking about acid, I think. 62, 63, 64. I'm not sure. Millbrook may have started.
No, wait a minute. Oh, yeah. Timing would be about like that.
I know that Leary took acid, I think, in 62. So,
well, I think he might have taken it before that. We talked about Elizabeth Wariner, the head of the psychology department at Berkeley.
Yeah, that's when you had the recall of that poem.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's because everybody in the class had to take LSD, and I think Leary was one of those people that was there that had taken that class that she had taught on poetry, but you couldn't take the class unless you took LSD first. And I think he was there, and this would have been when whatever date she moved down to work at the Tracy Foundation in Los Angeles. So I'm not sure about when Leary actually took his first official session, you know.
Right. Well, what it says here,
because Leary was an associate of hers at Berkeley, and I had given her the procedures in 1961.
Okay, it says here, Leary received his master's degree at Washington State University in 1946, and a PhD in psychology at the University of California, Berkeley in 1950. So that's where she was, in Berkeley, right?
Yeah, she was.
Yeah.
And you said he got his degree in 19 what?
His PhD. 50. PhD in 1950 at Berkeley.
This would have been 10 years later when he was an associate professor to Elizabeth Wariner.
No, it says here, the title of Leary's PhD dissertation was, quote, "The Social Dimensions of Personality, Group Structure, and Process." He went on to become an assistant professor at Berkeley, 1950 to 55. A director of psychiatric research at the Kaiser Family Foundation, 55 to 58. And a lecturer in psychology at Harvard University, 59 to 63. So he does take the acid, 62, 63, because that's when he gets kicked out.
Oh, okay, then I guess he didn't take that class. I thought this was something that I knew he'd been an associate professor, but not at that time. Okay.
Well,
good.
How did she get the acid?
I am not sure, but I suspect that it was from Myron Stolaroff.
Okay.
Who was in Palo Alto.
Right. So the Kaiser Family Foundation, 55 to 58, that'd be in California, I think, and was he could have been around her then.
Stolaroff, I don't think, got it until after we had it, or it might have been parallel. You know, I mentioned the number of doctors relating to Hollywood Hospital, that he might have been one of them that located in Palo Alto later, about 58, but he could have been there before. I just, the 57 is the marker I'm using, and I know about a year afterwards he gave LSD to Cary Grant, somewhere around there.
Here's what the Wikipedia says about him. In 1941, he received a master's degree in electrical engineering from Stanford University, and from 46 to 1960, 15 years, he worked for the recording equipment manufacturer Ampex, first as a senior design engineer and later as director of instrumentation marketing. He founded the International Foundation for Advanced Study in Menlo Park and served as its president from 60 to 70. During this time, he was the executive administrator for a research group conducting clinical studies with LSD and mescaline, which was administered to about 350 participants. And that's when he's working with Hubbard. I know that. So that begins in 1960. So Leary is at Kaiser.
So he wouldn't have been there.
It says the Kaiser Family Foundation was in Menlo Park.
Hmm. So I don't know.
Okay, now, it does say... Okay, so just going back to Leary, it says here, he's director of psychiatric research at Kaiser Family, and then her.
Who, Leary?
Yeah, Leary. And then.
What about Stolaroff?
Stolaroff,
you read the stuff about Stolaroff, and then Leary came into the same picture.
Yeah, Kaiser is at, Leary's at Menlo Park at Kaiser from 55 to 58. Stolaroff is in Menlo Park at Ampex, I think.
Later.
No, same period.
But not with the acid. The acid didn't start till later.
Till 1960.
Yeah.
Yeah, in 1960, but it's in the Menlo Park area. I don't know if Leary met Myron in Menlo Park before 1960.
So, might have been a source for him to take it at Harvard. He may have, I don't know where he got it from when he was at Harvard.
Right, so it says here he was officially expelled, okay, Leary's early work in psychology continued the exploration by such pioneers as Dr. Harry Stack Sullivan, Dr. Karen Horney, Sam Biglari, and others of the importance of interpersonal forces to mental health. Dr. Leary specifically focused on how the interpersonal process might be used to diagnose personality patterns or disorders. He developed a complex and respected interpersonal circumplex model published in the Interpersonal Diagnosis of Personality that offered a means by which psychologists could use MMPI scores to quickly determine a respondent's characteristic interpersonal modes of reaction. It is a credit to the robustness of his ideas that circumplex models continue to figure prominently in interpersonal research. Now, let me put the other phone on because mine's blipping here. Just a second. Okay, so it says in 1955, Leary's first wife committed suicide, leaving him to become a single parent to a son and daughter. Before his first experiments with mushrooms, Leary described his life of 35 years disparagingly, writing that he had been, quote, an anonymous institutional employee who drove to work each morning in a long line of commuter cars and drove home each night and drank martinis, like several million middle-class liberal intellectual robots. So, let's see. They talk about the Life magazine article by Gordon Wasson on May 13, 57, which is interesting. That could be a month or two after you took your LSD.
Yeah, let's see.
Yeah, we decided February,
yeah,
March.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's a synchrony. Dave Worster takes LSD, and within a month or two, Life magazine features an article on R. Gordon Wasson that documented and popularized the use of psilocybin mushrooms in the religious ceremony of the indigenous Mazatec people of Mexico. Anthony Russo, a colleague of Leary's, had recently...
Yes.
You knew that name, Anthony Russo?
Anthony Russo has popped up several times, but I've always wondered whether it was the same Anthony Russo. So,
you heard his name later and wondered...
Well, I know that in the Servants of Awareness, Anthony Russo was one of our members back on the East Coast, and then later I heard that he was an associate, I think, of the guy who released the Pentagon Papers. What's his name?
Ellsberg, Daniel Ellsberg.
Ellsberg. I think you'll find that he was in relation to him, too. But I'm not positive, because it could be. I also felt like he was a CIA agent, but you see that Anthony Russo may have been a name held by more than one person, or that one person may have been involved in all these different things.
Yeah.
I remember being curious about it long ago and then just dropping it, you know.
Oh, it's interesting. It comes back up. It says, Anthony Russo, a colleague of Leary's, had recently taken this psychedelic psilocybe mexicana during a trip to Mexico and related the experience to Leary.
Yes.
That's around 57. In August 1960, when Dave has gone to San Francisco and the center is closed, probably, Leary traveled to the Mexican city of Cuernavaca with Russo and tried psilocybin mushrooms for the first time. It's interesting if Russo keeps showing up on these. He took Leary to Mexico. And they tried psilocybin mushrooms for the first time, an experience that drastically altered the course of his life. In 1965, Leary commented that, quote, he learned more about his brain and its possibilities and more about psychology in the 5 hours after taking these mushrooms than he had in the preceding 15 years of studying, doing research in psychology. Upon his return to Harvard that fall of 60, Leary and his associates, notably Richard Alpert, later known as Ram Dum Dum, what would you call
him? No, Baba Ram Dass.
No, I'm saying Ram Rum Dum. But yeah, Ram Dass began a research program known as the Harvard Psilocybin Project. That goal was to analyze the effects of psilocybin on human subjects. In this case, prisoners and later students of the Andover Newton Theological Seminary, using a synthesized version of the then legal drug, one of two active compounds found in a wide variety of hallucinogenic mushrooms, including psilocybe mexicana. The compound was produced according to a recipe developed by research chemist Albert Hoffman of Sandoz Pharmaceuticals.
Well, that's all very debatable there, but go ahead.
Okay. Leary argued that psychedelics, used with the right dosage, set and setting, and with the guidance of psychology professionals, could alter behavior in unprecedented and beneficial ways. The goals of Leary's research included finding better ways to treat alcoholism and to reform convicted criminals. Many of Leary's research participants reported profound mystical and spiritual experiences, which they claim permanently altered their lives in a very positive manner. According to Leary's autobiography called Flashbacks, they administered LSD to 300 professors, graduate students, writers, and philosophers, and 75% of them reported as being like a revelation to them and one of the most educational experiences of their lives. But see, they're jumping ahead. I think the LSD isn't until 62. It says, Leary and Alpert founded the International Foundation for Internal Freedom in 1962 in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Now, if we go back to Stolaroff, I think he founded the International Foundation, okay, for Advanced Study in Menlo Park. All right, that's something different. All right.
And what date?
In 1960. And
yeah.
Leary's forming his International Foundation for Internal Freedom in 62. This was run by Lisa Biberman, now known as Licia Kooning, a protege of Leary's and also one of his many lovers. Around this time, their Harvard colleagues grew uneasy about their research. So, in May 63, Leary and Alpert were dismissed from Harvard after college authorities alleged that undergraduates had shared in the researchers' drugs. Now, that's the time when Doobie is now channeling organization of awareness stuff.
He started to channel in the summer of...
No.
Well, I don't know when he started.
He started Thanksgiving.
That's right, Thanksgiving, but it surfaced for me in the summer of 63.
Okay, so yeah, he starts triggered by Stan Collins and Lucille Ryman in end of November 62. He starts doing it by early 63 regularly. The Organization of Awareness is formed. But that's the time.
First it was the Hazelwood Association, because that was the street on which she lived.
Oh, okay. And is that where the suite was, the penthouse suite that you designed?
No. That was, he was living there. He was living there. Lucille was living on Hazelwood Lane in Bellevue. And so he would have meetings out at her place. But he was living in the penthouse with a very old woman who I designed the penthouse for when I was working for Seattle Bronze Company.
Right. So it says, Leary's activities interested siblings Peggy, Billy, and Tommy Hitchcock, heirs to the Mellon fortune, who in 1963 helped Leary and his associates acquire the use of a rambling mansion on an estate in the town of Millbrook.
And that's where your friend Boart stepped in and met her and married her.
Yes, he married her many years later after... Tim Leary,
she was Tim Leary's lover. What I heard was she was Tim Leary's lover, and Boart showed up with a woman, and during the first meeting, they switched girlfriends.
Well,
and then later married.
Okay, here's the way Boart tells it. He told it to me many times. He is in Puerto Rico around this time. He's dropped out. I don't think he's had taken acid or anything, but he's dropped out, and he's living with his first wife, and they may have had a child there in the wilderness of Puerto Rico. But when he comes back, he starts the East Village Other in 1965. Now, I don't know when he hooks up with Millbrook. Meanwhile, in the 65 period, Leary, who's been at Millbrook, nobody has confirmed, people like Gerd Stern and other people, and Peggy. I interviewed Peggy in depth for many hours, and she says that she was not a lover of Tim Leary's. But what happened is the actress Uma Thurman,
yes.
I might have heard of her, her mother was a model, a Norwegian or Swedish model, in New York, found out, got interested in the Millbrook scene, went up there, and met Leary, and then Leary and she became lovers, and Leary married her. And they traveled around the world. You see pictures of it in...
And Mildred Grace Ponch was at Millbrook.
Yes, your friend Mildred we're talking about, that was the reserve person and got acid and loved Disneyland.
And went back there, I don't know, whenever Millbrook occurred.
63. So she is going back there after you've gone to Seattle. See, you're not around anymore. And she's in San Francisco, and she ends up out with Leary. But Uma Thurman's mother marries Tim. They go around the world for a while. I think it's in flashbacks. It has pictures of them traveling to Japan or someplace. But they're only together for a year. But Uma Thurman's mother is, of course, a very close friend of Peggy's. And Peggy and Tim and Uma Thurman's mother. What's her name? Uma Thurman's mother, Carolyn? You later met her. But anyway, I forget her name. But she, Nina or something? Nena, right, Nena. So Nena and Leary divorce after about a year or so. And Nena then gets involved with Robert Thurman, who is the present-day major sponsor of the Tibetan House and the Dalai Lama. He and Nena are major funders of that, and Peggy Mellon Hitchcock is a funder of that through her friendship with Uma Thurman's mother and Robert Thurman, who is a professor of Buddhism at Columbia.
Now, far out.
Yeah, now Walter Boward comes into this scene, and by 66, 67, the East Village Other, which he had created with a couple other people, was becoming very popular. And so Leary meets with McLuhan and asks McLuhan how he could spread the LSD message. And it's very interesting. Leary quotes what McLuhan said to him in his book Flashbacks, and it's pretty amazing what McLuhan said, but I won't go into those details right now, but he inspires Leary. Leary goes and has a shower, and in the shower, he says, he thought of this jingle. Turn on, tune in, drop out. As a result of meeting McLuhan. So he gets fascinated with the East Village Other, and he offers to Boward, according to Walter Boward, he says, let me have the East Village Other, and you can have Peggy. Now, it's odd that he thinks he can give Peggy. Now, maybe Peggy is totally in awe with Leary and will do his bidding, but it doesn't mean they're lovers. So,
and this is when?
66, 67, in that period, maybe 68. I'm not sure. I know by 68, Boward has left the East Village Other, and he goes out to New Mexico, where a place called Paradise is in New Mexico or Arizona,
yep,
where they come together. And Walter, it's either Peggy's family territory or cottage or whatever, or they buy it. And so Walter Boward with Peggy, he was hanging out with Peggy in New York. He talks about going to her Park Avenue apartment. So they were, I guess, an item. But Walter, he gets, what's that thing when you get really tired?
Oh, yeah, mono.
Not mono, but it begins with H, you know, really exhausted.
Well, go ahead. He
gets hepatitis. Maybe it's hepatitis.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Right, but you're tired with that?
Oh, I'm sure.
No, I'm asking.
I think
Carolyn.
That's part of the symptoms.
Yeah, I'm asking Carolyn. It's hepatitis, I think. He can hardly move. Yeah, Carolyn says it's hepatitis. And he can't move at the cottage. He's exhausted. And Peggy, though, determines, according to Walter, that she wants to have a good, healthy guy be the father of her children. She's already been married twice, I think. And she says Walter was the perfect, he was a handsome, strong guy. So she drags him to the wedding, and he doesn't want to marry her. She drags him to the wedding, and they get married. Now, Walter goes on about, he said, there was some planning on his part. He said, I became America's first yuppie. I decided to infiltrate the richest people in America, or that class, through Peggy. So he'll say in one breath that he was dragged to the wedding reluctantly, and but at the same time, he at some point decided, well, this is okay, I'll infiltrate the rich people. So that's Walter's story about Peggy. Let's see. Now, I interviewed Peggy in 1999 in the spring for 13 and a half hours, and it's all on tape, and I did it for Peggy so that she could give it to her daughters so that her daughters would know what her life was, which was pretty amazing, because the daughters, Peggy says when she was young, she'd write letters to her mother. The generation of born in the 70s did not write letters, so they didn't know anything about her life. So we did this tape series for her daughters. Walter died last December, and I spoke to the daughters around the arrangements for the funeral, and they had still not heard the tapes yet. Though Peggy spoke to me on the phone at that time and thanked me for doing those tapes, thought it was so great. And but
now, were these daughters by Boart?
Yes, by Walter.
Yeah. Yes.
And the daughters said, one of them, Sophia, said that she was definitely going to listen to those tapes now. Now, they apparently live out here in Hawaii somewhere, so they have property here as well as in Tucson, Arizona. So they're not on our island, Maui, but we might run across them and find out if they did listen to the tapes. But we're back, going back to that sequence. That's what you heard about Peggy and Walter. Then there's my version, and then there's Peggy's version on the tape.
Uh-huh.
She was married or involved with a top doctor in New York in the mid-60s and was head of the social scene in New York City in the mid-60s while Millbrook was happening. So she was really the social queen in the mid-60s because she had Millbrook happening and all the jazz guys and artists going up there to take the acid with Leary. That was happening, but also she was part of a main Park Avenue social scene in New York with this psychiatrist guy. So, so we're talking about all this because of Grace and the background to Wes Wilson and Bob Carr. So Bob Carr, it's now about 1964, and he says, I've been doing print work for the past 4 years for the insurance company. They were moving their head office to Pasadena in Southern California, and they wanted me to move there with them. I thought it over and refused their offer, although it was tempting. I decided to open my own print shop in the financial district just a few blocks from North Beach. And Wes came aboard to help with the graphics and the photo end of printing. Do you recall any of that scene?
Yes, I remember being there, and Wes was there. He was, and as I recall, that one thing Bob was doing, he was doing counseling for former prisoners, sometimes prisoners, and so I think that Wes Wilson was a kid who had some trouble, and Bob was a counselor, and that's how they got in relation. So Bob put him to work.
Okay, so
he was about, at that time, I think Wes Wilson was, I don't think he was 21 yet. I think he was maybe 20, but I don't know.
Okay, well, I'm just putting in, he was born in, Robert Wesley Wilson was born in 37. An American artist, one of the leading designers of psychedelic posters.
So he's born in 37, 47, 57.
So he's 27. Yeah, that would fit, 27.
Oh, he didn't look it. He looked younger, but that's all right.
Right, because if in 64, that would be 27, and so he's 10 years older than Bob. So you're right, he's younger. Wes Wilson is 10 years, almost 10 years older than Bob Carr, so it's true.
Now, wait a minute. Bob Carr was born in 1928.
Yeah, and Wes Wilson was born in 37. So Wes Wilson is 10 years younger.
Younger, yeah.
Oh, was I saying older?
Yeah.
Okay, this Maui lifestyle.
Oh, you mean it's the Dobbs lifestyle.
Yeah, the Dobbs lifestyle.
Tumble.
Yeah. It's all that salt water I drink in every morning, surfing.
Et cetera.
Yeah.